Thanks, Bill. I get a little nervous when I speak, and it causes me the night before to dream a lot. I had this very unusual dream last night. I thought I might share with you kind of a dream in anticipation of being here today. I actually dreamed that I died and I went to heaven, and there was this huge cloud that I was walking on top of, and there was this ladder at one portion of the cloud, and right beside it was an old-time chalkboard. And a guy came out from behind the ladder chalkboard and said that he was St. Peter, and he was going to let me into heaven. But there's one thing I had to do before I could enter, and I had to just record everything that I'd done wrong all my life. And he went behind the chalkboard, and he brought this piece of chalk, and it was like the size of a just huge slab of bologna. I could kind of put it on my shoulder, and he said, just make a little check mark every time you remember something. Work your way across the chalkboard, keep climbing the ladder, and when you're finished, come down, and I'll let you in. So I remember kind of climbing this ladder and making these little check marks and making the different rows, and I kind of stopped one time, and I looked, and I couldn't even see where I'd begun. And so I kept going, and I kind of came to the point where I remembered the last thing I'd ever done wrong. That piece of chalk was still about the same size, and I kind of grabbed the rung of the ladder and reached over to make that little check mark, and all of a sudden I felt this excruciating pain on my left hand on the ladder. And it was a foot, and I looked up, and there was Bill Parkinson. And he was coming down for more chalk. True story. True story. Well, Beth and I, the last few years, have had the opportunity to work within Campus Crusade for Christ in many different ways. But we have a kind of a rich history within CRU, and just want to kind of show you some familiar faces that you might be aware of here. And we're going to work on getting this up here. It's not doing it. Hold on a second. I know exactly what I'm... No. Oh, it'd be neat to have shown this. Hold on a second. No.
That's the better half.
That's exactly right. Not sure. Okay. Oh. Is anybody's teenager here in the room that could kind of come up and fix this for me? Okay, I'll try one more thing here. No. I'm afraid to go out and come back in, but we'll try it. Okay, while this is, I'm going to shut it down. We're going to come back, and we're going to look at some other thoughts here. For the last 6 or 7 years, we've worked within Campus Crusade for Christ and with a group of people, and we call it kind of our SAGE phase. We have 21% of our staff in the United States are 55 years of age and older. And that's 1,200 staff. And so there's a team of us that have been working with kind of our legacy phase people. And they hit in different categories. Some of you kind of are on the other side of that, and in terms of where you are and what you're doing, you really feel comfortable with that. There are some people just kind of entering that phase. They're trying to get more perspective about life and what's going on. And then there are some people who are just kind of uncertain. And so there's some trigger statements that that we've heard. And feel free to laugh or feel free to pat your husband, wife on the shoulder, or your friend if these relate to you. But I'm not sure what's next for me. I feel like I'm being put out to pasture. I want to finish well. I have plenty to give. I used to have a budget and people reporting to me. Nobody is seeking me out for advice, and I've got a lot to give. I just can't play golf forever. Everyone my age seems so old and disengaged. You can't make old friends. I can still get things done, but just not as much. And I'm not sure what the future holds for me. Hey, come on forward. I'm going to give you access here to my computer, and let's see if we can do this. I have great faith in you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Maybe misplaced, but...
We're completely out of PowerPoint.
Okay. You can't put it behind my back. Can I do it in the front? Is that okay?
I can still get things done, but just not as much. I'm not sure what the future holds for me. I want to leave something that remains beyond my lifetime. I want to have my life counted for something. I can do more. I'm just not sure what that is. And my focus in accomplishing things has become limited. I can't do as much as I used to. And we all know that we face pace and energy and schedule, and those are realities in our life. And so when we talk about a game plan for this season of life, we may be at different phases of this game plan. Some of us may be really doing well, excited about who we are, what we're accomplishing. A lot of us may be just kind of sitting on the bench, not sure what's next. And when we're sitting on the bench, there's some things to really consider, kind of how to fully engage in the game. There's probably three things we need to look at in sitting on the bench. One is we need to kind of learn from our past. And that's probably just kind of taking inventory. What are the principles that kind of guided my life? What are the biblical perspectives that are really important to me? What are the things I'd never do again? What are the things I'd always want to do again? And we're just kind of doing an assessment, kind of looking at the past to get kind of an overview. Second, as we kind of look at who we are in terms of our gifts, skills, and abilities. And when we do that, we want to look at the things we really enjoy. And as we've been involved with others, it's brought them joy and pleasure also. And it's kind of tools in a toolbox. It's maybe projects we've done or activities we've been involved in, or ways in which we've helped or ministered in the lives of other people. And at this point in our lives, they're not a lot of new tools. They're kind of old tools. They've been used a lot. We have a lot of confidence in them. And that's kind of what we think the future would hold for us.
Should be good to go.
Okay. Hey, don't quite leave yet. Just... and so let me finish this third point, but then we have to leave the bench? How do we leave the bench? We're sitting on the bench. We were playing in the game at one time. We were starting. We were doing really well. Or it could be a game related to just activities we've done with children and different types of things, and there's been a system that's worked. But now we've kind of got to realize that it could be a similar game, but it could be a very different game that we're playing in the fourth quarter. And the fourth quarter kind of is what determines the end of the game. And so it may be something that's very different than what we've been doing. It may be even kind of an identity crisis when things that have been good in the past we don't see in the present. Sometimes we have to break free from an extreme loyalty to something in order to do something different that might even be much better. For some of us, we have to break free from being on the stage all the time and being the decision maker and feeling like we're in charge. We've got to break free from stereotypes of what other people say that we should be doing. We've got to kind of make sure we're not just trying to put our stamp on something in terms of a next activity. And sometimes it's kind of learning what it is to be invisible, kind of be behind the scenes, getting the things done. Maybe people don't know we're there, but it's really valuable things that we're doing. Oh. Okay. It's working. Bill and Ann Parkinson, and that is Little Bill. I've only known him as Little Bill. I lived with the Parkinsons for a year, my first year on staff. He was my director, and there was a house that had a little kind of a separate bedroom area. And when Little Bill came home, and I kind of held him up and was just looking at him, and he just threw up all over me. I know you all know him, but that's my experience with Little Bill. And then here's one of the women's Bible studies. And that's in the bottom left-hand corner, that's Star Chenault. You would know her as Star Boschetti. And then in the background there, with the Kappa Kappa Gamma sweatshirt, is Barb Peterson, better known as Barbara Rainey, who were involved in those early years. And then number 25 at the spring break outreach at Daytona Beach in 70 or 71, Robert Lewis. And so these were fun times. I know some people here in the audience, and I look at John and Debbie Reese, and I think, Debbie never grows old. And John kind of does, but that's okay. So one of the other trigger statements is, this is from Dablemont Body Shop, where I've taken my car in several times, and this is on the little cork board in the office, which is one room. It says, God put me on earth to accomplish a certain number of things, and right now I'm so far behind, I will never be able to die. And you may feel like that. So we talked about getting off the bench and entering and staying in the game. There's three foundational principles that are related to this phase of life and staying in the game. And they're really relational in nature, as Bill was mentioning earlier. And there's a TED Talk that was given on what's called the Harvard Grant Study, which is probably the most extensive study on human development. And I want us to listen to it. Now, it might take a little bit of time for it to load up, because it talks about relationships.
We're given the impression that these are the things that we need to go after in order to have a good life. Pictures of entire lives, of the choices that people make and how those choices work out for them, those pictures are almost impossible to get. Most of what we know about human life, we know from asking people to remember the past. And as we know, hindsight is anything but 20/20. We forget vast amounts of what happens to us in life. And sometimes memory is downright creative. But what if we could watch entire lives as they unfold through time? What if we could study people from the time that they were teenagers all the way into old age to see what really keeps people happy and healthy? We did that. The Harvard study of adult development may be the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. For 75 years, we've tracked the lives of 724 men. Year after year, asking about their work, their home lives, their health, and of course, asking all along the way without knowing how their life stories were going to turn out. Since 1938, we've tracked the lives of two groups of men. The first group started in the study when they were sophomores at Harvard College. They all finished college during World War II, and then most went off to serve in the war. And the second group that we've followed was a group of boys from Boston's poorest neighborhoods, boys who were chosen for the study specifically because they were from some of the most troubled and disadvantaged families in the Boston of the 1930s. Most lived in tenements, many without hot and cold running water. Many of the inner city Boston men ask us, "Why do you keep wanting to study me? My life just isn't that interesting." The Harvard men never ask that question. So what have we learned? What are the lessons that come from the tens of thousands of pages of information that we've generated on these lives? Well, the lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder and harder. The clearest message that we get from this 75-year study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. We've learned three big lessons about relationships. The first is that social connections are really good for us and that loneliness kills. It turns out that people who are more socially connected to family, to friends, to community, are happier, they're physically healthier, and they live longer than people who are less well connected. And the experience of loneliness turns out to be toxic. People who are more isolated than they want to be from others find that they are less happy, their health declines earlier in midlife, their brain functioning declines sooner, and they live shorter lives than people who are not lonely. So the second big lesson that we learned is that it's not just the number of friends you have, and it's not whether or not you're in a committed relationship, but it's the quality of your close relationships that matters. And the third big lesson that we learn about relationships and our health is that good relationships don't just protect our bodies, they protect our brains. It turns out that being in a securely attached relationship to another person in your 80s is protective, that the people who are in relationships where they really feel they can count on the other person in times of need, those people's memories stay sharper longer. And the people in relationships where they feel they really can't count on the other one, those are the people who experience earlier memory decline. Just like the millennials in that recent survey, many of our men, when they were starting out as young adults, really believed that fame and wealth and high achievement were what they needed to go after to have a good life. But over and over, over these 75 years, our study has shown that the people who fared the best were the people who leaned into relationships with family, with friends, with community. I'd like to close with a quote from Mark Twain. More than a century ago, he was looking back on his life, and he wrote this: "There isn't time, so brief is life, for bickerings, apologies, heartburnings, callings to account. There is only time for loving, and but an instant, so to speak, for that. The good life is built with good relationships, Thank you.
So I want us to look at three foundational principles in this phase of life, in this sage phase. And the first one is have a clear purpose for life. You know, the most important emotional developmental decision a person ever makes in their life is what's called the dream for their life. And we want to look at that this morning, not in the sense of my gifts, skills, and abilities, vocationally, what's best for me. I kind of want to set that aside and say, what is the dream that God has for each one of us? And I think it's very clear in Scripture. Genesis 1:26, it talks about we're created in His image, according to His likeness, that He created us, that His attributes might be displayed through our life and character. And we know that happens not because we're working hard to be people of character, but it is because we are so deeply bonded to Christ that He transforms us to become like Him. John 15:5 refers to it as abiding, like a branch abides in a vine, draws its nourishment, its dependence, its sustenance completely. John 17:22. Jesus is talking to His Father about His disciples. And He says, "And the glory that You've given to Me, I've given to them, that they may be one even as We are one, You and Me, I and them, that they would be matured in this unity." And there's a relational glory that God wants us to experience with Him. Us experiencing who He is, Him experiencing who we are, and that's like the relationship that the Trinity has with each other. And then we could look at Matthew 22:35-38, which you're familiar with, which would be the great commandment. And the lawyers are going in and they're questioning Jesus and they're trying to catch Him up so that they can kind of look like they're dominant in terms of their thinking. And they're asking Him finally, in appointing an attorney who was good at debate and saying, what is the greatest commandment? And for the Pharisees, spirituality was things that they did. And the greatest among them was the person who had accomplished the most. And this was a gotcha question for Jesus because they knew whatever commandment He would mention, they could go after Him. And they could talk about one that they thought was better and they could turn it, you know, into this big discussion on works. But Jesus' reply to the greatest commandment was, love the Lord with all your heart, soul, and mind. And what He was saying to them is spirituality is not things you do. It's a relationship you experience with Me. And so when we look at this dream that God has for us, the first part of it is for who we are in a deep bonded relationship with Him, and that is the nature of His creation of us. There's a second aspect to this I call covenant relationships. God gives us covenant relationships in life, a few people where we experience relationship with Him, with them like we do with God. There are four types of covenant relationships: God to His people, husband to a wife, or wife to a husband, parents to children, and close friends of the same gender. This is what I do within Crew. I look at a first love emphasis of never leaving our love for Christ, and then I drop down to, with men, helping them to develop covenant teams of peers or kingdom citizen relationships where they're processing life personally and spiritually, potentially for the rest of their lives. It's not incidental. It keeps us out of that loneliness and isolation. And it helps us in a practical way to experience deep bonded relationship with others like we do with God. It has three primary benefits. One is this, that we know God deeper because we are processing life with others in the way in which we process life with Him. Secondly, it keeps us from going off on rabbit trails in life, which men are prone to do. We just end up doing stupid things when we're out there in isolation. But when we have people we're processing life with, it helps us to stay on track. And thirdly, it helps us to make it personally and spiritually for a lifetime when very few people do. So covenant relationships is a foundation point in terms of the fourth quarter and being in the game. And then thirdly, is leaving a legacy in terms of what we do that has a oneness with God. And this is the time where we want to make sure we have the foundation of the intimacy of relationship. We want to have covenant friendships in life where we're processing life together. And then what we do, we want to have a oneness with God in the doing of it. It's just not us grabbing the next thought or the next thing, but it's the opportunity to be saying, God, would you direct me? Would you guide me in this next step? It's leaving a oneness in what we do, not just in who we are. And I kind of have four bullet points that help me keep this together, because the priority of relationship is a greater priority than accomplishment. And so I say character is more important than competency. Godliness is superior to giftedness. The depth of intimacy that we experience with Christ is of far greater value than any position to which we could attain, any responsibility we could ever be given, or any task that we could ever perform, and who we are is more important than what we do. So there's some criteria that are involved in leaving a legacy. There are six criteria. We've got a foundation, and now there's some criteria that relate, in a sense, to what we do. It has to be a mission that transcends self. And this is a phrase I'm very grateful to Robert Lewis for years ago. Having that phrase, transcending self. In other words, mission, direction in our lives right now is not self-focused. It was never intended to be self-focused. It's a God and others focus. It's an investment that is relational. You know, as the TED Talk shared, as Bill shared earlier, that the future in terms of what we do is not about accomplishing more necessarily, but it's really an investment that's relational. And it's a legacy that endures. A legacy that endures. This is a picture of my great-great-grandfather, Abram Carter Goodrich. He was born in 1813. The only reason I know his name or anything about him is he hand-wrote an autobiography of his life that when my father passed away about 10 years ago, we discovered this in some old papers. And so he recorded his life. He became a Christian at age 17. He lived in a county in North Carolina. And back then, the church buildings were like cabins. They weren't very big. They didn't have a lot of windows. In the summer, it was really hot inside. And they were going to have what's called a brush arbor meeting. Has anybody ever heard that expression before? Yeah. And it's kind of a precursor to what we call a revival. So a preacher was going to come in and be there for a couple of days. And the brush arbor was something that they built. And so my great-great-grandfather at age 17, his dad put him on the work crew to build the brush arbor. And you'd sink these huge logs into the ground. Then up at the top, you'd build a lattice work, and then you'd put brush on top so that when you're out there all day for the revival, the sun wouldn't be as bad, and if there were a breeze, it could easily get to you. Except the day before the revival, when he was up on the top, he fell through the lattice work, and on the way down, he so badly bruised his thighs that he couldn't walk. And his dad picked him up and took him home, but the next day, he brought him early in the morning, leaned him up against one of those wooden poles, and he sat there the whole day because he couldn't move. And so he heard everything that was said. And it's recorded in his own handwriting. And there was a high school student who gave their testimony. And he gave their name. And he gave the name of the pastor and his main points. And the pastor who was passing through was one of the founders of Richmond University, which, when it was founded, was a Baptist school. And he came to know Christ that day. And then he talks about how his family moved from Virginia to northwestern Missouri. And by that time, he had become an itinerant pastor where he would visit churches and be the pastor for five or six churches around. And then they moved down to Hillsboro, Texas, where he was an itinerant pastor. And then their final journey was to Norman, Oklahoma, where he was a pastor. And his obituary in the Norman transcript says one of the early day pastors in Norman, Oklahoma. Now, what's interesting is I am his legacy. Never met him, never would have known anything about him had he not written down his life story. And that is a lasting legacy. And it's relational. And you never know in your life the impact upon your children, your grandchildren, your neighbors, your friends, the people in your Bible study, the people you work with, as you've been involved spiritually in their lives. Beth's going to come up and share a story of a friend of hers. And it talks about the fulfillment of the desires of our heart being a legacy criteria.
Now you can hear me. Oh, yeah. Hey, it's so fun for me to sit here and see Debbie Reese out in the audience. I was a resident assistant when I was a junior in college. And Debbie and her roommate, Kathy Wood Marshall, would just jog along in front of my little room. And they were so happy. I just couldn't figure out anything about them because they were so calm. And I was real intense about school. And they just kind of chilled out. And they loaned me a record. And it had music on it. It had some things about Jesus and a story about Jesus. And I listened to it all over and over and over. And sometime during that year, I came to know Christ in my dorm room realized that I had seen this in Kathy and Debbie. And so it's just such a blessing. Thank you for living the Lord and having a part in my life, too. So, well, I wanted to tell you about my friend Gwen. I love her so much, and what she represents to me is how God uses our character to develop us, and then where we are in life now is we influence other people through the character that we have and the giftedness that God has helped us realize and develop over the years. This house up here, this rock house, belongs to my friend Gwen Todd. And pretty soon, the spring will come out and the flowers around her house will be developed. She has pink dogwoods there. She has a yellow forsythia. She has a red violet crepe myrtle. And right around this time, they're all going to just bloom. She planted one of the trees after her mother died right outside her mother's window. And this house is where Gwen was brought as a newborn. She came there with her family, with her mom and dad, and was joined by two brothers. And she grew up with these two brothers and her mom and dad her entire life in a little bedroom in this house. Well, Gwen also lives in Earlington, Kentucky. At present, that town is 1,354 people. And it was always small like that. Gwen had a loving upbringing, but she went away to college, had a great time in college. I'm not really sure when she came to know Christ, but After college, she joined the staff of Campus Crusade for Christ, or CRU, as it's known now. And she went to several different locations, but eventually she ended up in Vienna, Austria, and that's where I got to know her. And Gwen was a servant to many people. One of the things that she did was she helped navigate staff through all the operational details they needed to minister there. At the time, Eastern Europe was still communist, and the way to have any kind of ministry, you had to kind of go undercover, often as students within different countries. We had a number of single women who were there, a lot of families. She helped people just be able to stay in countries. There was martial law in Poland for a while there, and she helped get them food and all kinds of things, and help people with medical things, all kinds of stuff. But Gwen helped people remain where they were. There were a number of single women in countries. I think of one in particular who was in Yugoslavia, and she was all alone. She didn't even have much heat in her house. She just really went through tough times ministering. So a lot of these single women would come to Vienna, Austria for R&R. And Gwen loved to have them stay with her because she is very hospitable. That's kind of like the thing about Gwen, is that she loves to have people around. She calls that hospitality, as she wants everybody to be happy that they're there. And she has that great ability to do. But anyway, she lived in a rather nondescript high-rise in Vienna in a small two-bedroom apartment, and she had her bedroom and then a guest room. And the guest room was kind of back a little bit, and it was really dark back there. She had had a bunk bed in there. But the women would love to come visit Gwen because they were so tired and exhausted by different things, and they could go back in those bunk beds and sleep and sleep and sleep. So, and Gwen herself was such a great hostess. In fact, instead of calling it the back room, one of the women called it the back womb because it was so nurturing for her. So Gwen ministered in Vienna, Austria for around 20 years. But during that time, when that was happening, some alarming things started happening in her home. Her father died when he was 67, kind of unexpectedly. And she had two brothers in their 40s, but they died in their 40s. So Gwen was left as the person. It was up to her to care for her mom. Her mom didn't know how to drive. The dad had died at 67. The mom was 65. So Gwen came back and taught her mother how to drive and helped her acclimate around her house and around the town and be able to get somewhere to the grocery store and so on. And then she went back to Vienna and continued ministering and helping people there. But when they got the diagnosis that her mother had Alzheimer's, she knew she needed to come back. And it was a time of kind of self-crisis because her identity was tied in to caring for all these people. It was her place. She was known by many people. She loved them. But when she realized she needed to go back and care for her mother, she said, I thought, what will become of me? I'm just going back there to my little bedroom and take care of my mother. And she said, I thought my life was over. But she knew this is what God wanted her to do. She went back to stay with her mother, take care of her. And I don't know what she thought when she first went home, but you can imagine having a life experience of going a lot of places and then going back to your little bedroom in the same room where you grew up, taking care of your mother in the room right next to you, not being able to leave very much. But Gwen said that God did all kinds of things in her life and with other people. She couldn't travel. She took care of her mom, and over time, there was more. She couldn't leave her mom so much as time went on. But she said God taught her so much, and one of the things was she realized God had given her an opportunity to be a mother when she'd never been another before. She was a mother to her mother. And then she said she also was able to give to her mother what her mother was never able to give to her. And it was just a sweet time. And she'd just tell her mother, "You're just the cutest little thing." And she said her mother had a very sweet personality. And now her mother died after 11 years. And that room where her mother was, she calls it the sweet room because of her mom and the place and all the things that got taught her. Now, after her mom died after these 11 years, she decided to work again on campus. And she went to work with international students in Kentucky. And she decided to stay in this little rock house. The thing that bothered her was that it was a longer distance from campus, so the international students, it was difficult for them to drive back to her house before she could be hospitable. But she said, "Beth, I learned that I could still be hospitable." And she said, "I am still hospitable. I do it with just my person." And she said she realized that wherever she was, she could use that just by being herself. Whenever I see Gwen at a conference, she is surrounded by loving, adoring students who just think the world of her. And, I think how what could have been a real oppressive thing, God made a very sweet thing and used her life in a great way. In fact, this picture is on her Facebook page. And when a student or friend saw that, this is their comment. They said, "Gwen lives in Snow White's cottage." Isn't that dear? Whoops. Sorry, David. I messed you up here.
Thanks, Beth. Two other characteristics of criteria is it's a good work that is God-focused and directed. And this is something, once again, we want to have that oneness with God in the doing of it. And then lastly, sometimes there's the grace gift of a team. It's not just something we're doing, but a group of people are doing it. And we're joined together in that. And that sometimes that happens, sometimes that doesn't. But boy, what a gift that is. Three design principles to keep in mind during this phase of our life. I have to focus on doing a few things well. Now, many of you are gifted. There's lots of things you've been involved in. And those could have been related to business, those could have been related to schools, families, all kinds of things. And we've kind of run the show for many, many years, but pace, energy, schedule enter in, and what we have to do is rather than dabble in a lot of things, just do one or two things really well. Beth and I lived in Southern California on two different occasions, and I would go up the High Sierras for about 4 or 5 hours, and there's incredible trout fishing up there. I like to trout fish, and Bishop and Lone Pine, if you're familiar with the area, just beautiful. But as I would go up there, I would cross the California Aqueduct several times, and the California Aqueduct brings water from the Sierra Mountains down into Los Angeles and provides water for millions and millions of people. But if you were, it's a concrete bed that's open, but if you were to take a sledgehammer and you were to hit that concrete bed and make a dent in it and maybe do it 2 or 3 times along the way, lots of water would flow out literally into the Mojave Desert. And many acres might flourish, but it would not have the impact that it would being drinking water for millions of people in Southern California. It has to be channeled. And we have to be channeled and directed into a couple of things that we do well. And then in those couple of things, I'm responsible for the depth of what I do. I'm to be a good steward who cultivates results. give it my best shot with the ability, the time, the effort that I have. But also I have to realize that God's responsible for the breadth. This could be an incredible time in a person's life where things are exploding and happening and unbelievable things taking place. But it could be just a time that God chooses to be an impact with just a few, or maybe just one person. There's a video that you're familiar with, and it's the story of Robertson McQuilkin. Family Life developed this video, and Robertson McQuilkin at one time was the president of Columbia College and Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina. He and his wife were missionaries to Japan for 17 years. He wrote theological books. He traveled and he spoke worldwide. I heard him at a conference that Campus Crusade had in the 90s in Dallas, Texas, where he was the main speaker. And he was well respected and known. And kind of as he and his wife entered their latter years, she developed Alzheimer's disease. And when he was there in a consistent way, she was fine. But when he was traveling or away, she would become irritated and become difficult. And he realized there was a decision that was facing him. And he decided to no longer travel, no longer write, and to step down from being the president of the school and the seminary to be a caregiver to his wife for the remainder of her life. And this is a video clip where he's announcing to the seminary students and the faculty and professors this decision that he's made.
I haven't in my life experienced easy decision-making on major decisions, but one of the simplest and clearest decisions I've had to make is this one, because circumstances dictated it. Muriel, now, in the last couple of months, seems to be almost happy when with me, and almost never happy when not with me. In fact, she seems to feel trapped, becomes very fearful, sometimes almost terror. And when she can't get to me, there can be anger. She's in distress. But when I'm with her, she's happy and contented. And so I must be with her at all times. And you see, it's not only that I promised in sickness and in health, till death do us part, and I'm a man of my word. But as I have said, I don't know with this group, but I've said publicly, it's the only fair thing. She sacrificed for me for 40 years to make my life possible. So, if I cared for her for 40 years, I'd still be in debt. However, there's much more. It's not that I have to, it's that I get to. I love her very dearly, and you can tell it's not easy to talk about. She's a delight. It's a great honor to care for such a wonderful person.
Robertson McQuilkin is known all over the world. And it's not for the books he's written, or the positions that he's held, or the ministry that he's done. It's because he chose to be a man of character and be a caregiver to his wife for the rest of her life. And God's responsible for the breadth. And it could be a difference in one person's life. So, as we're looking at some design principles and some criteria, kind of one closing thought is, how do we in faith kind of make this decision or directionally look at it? And I'm reminded of Abraham in Genesis 22, where God told him to take his son Isaac, go to Mount Moriah, sacrifice his son on that mountain. The next day he got up, he went on a three-day journey. They came to Mount Moriah. He had his son, he had the fire, he had the wood, he built the altar, and just as he was about to make the sacrifice, the angel stopped him, and it said, and he turned, and he looked, and he saw a ram in the thicket, which was to be the sacrifice. And God said to Abraham, because you have not withheld anything from me, and you have obeyed my voice, then I will bless you. And you see, the whole journey, the whole trip, the whole sacrifice of Isaac was a test that God had given to Abraham to discern if there was something more important to him than his relationship with God. And there wasn't. He passed that test. And then he said, and you have obeyed my voice. Now, the term obey that's used there in the Old Testament is not how we think of obey, having, gosh, to do things we don't want to do or wouldn't enjoy, but they're right. No, it means to intelligently hear from God. And obey in the New Testament means to attentively listen to God. And so because he was attentively listening to God, he wanted to intelligently hear what God was saying, he was able to turn from what had been a clear direction to a different direction just by turning and looking and seeing something and know that that was what was promised. That was what he needed to pursue. So if you're not knowing directionally what's next, first of all, the Lord's working in all of our lives that we're fully surrendered to him. And then secondly, listen to him. Listen to what he might say and step out in faith in doing that. Let me pray for us. Lord, thanks for the time this morning. Thank you that you love us. You're more concerned about us than you are results in our lives. And you're more concerned that we would reflect who you are than that we would accomplish something and have our stamp upon it. And so, Lord, during this critical time in our lives, the fourth quarter, help us to be engaged in the game that you have designed for us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you.